Yeah, well, first of all, Jim, this is Trump 2.0. So we went through all this, his attack on immigrants and immigrant communities from 2016 to 2020 during Trump 1.0. And so we were ready for this, and we were preparing for this moment because we knew he was coming hard after immigrants. And immigrant communities are everywhere in this country. It's the demographic of our country has changed dramatically, and immigrants are, I think, have become a main part of our social and economic fabric of our country, and Trump is trying to tear that apart. Data after data reports have shown that the crime, immigrant communities, especially undocumented immigrant, really commit crimes. I mean, there are crimes committed, they do commit, no different than the population of US-born citizens commit crimes as well. But when you compare it, the data, the crime rate for immigrants in this country, especially undocumented immigrants, is much lower than the crime rate for other groups. And I think there's a lot of misinformation. He's throwing terminology about us all being murderers, gang members, drug smugglers, rapists. These are fear tactics, and this is misinformation that we just need to counter and provide different kinds of data. I focus on, in my work at the Labor Center, I focus on research on the economy, especially research when it relates to immigrant workers. And, here in California, for example, we're the fifth largest economy in the whole world. I mean, we have really subsidized the entire country, the California economy. A big part of the workforce in California is immigrant workers. There are industries like agriculture, where the majority of workers are immigrant workers, mostly undocumented workers. They fuel the economy. They give vibrancy to the economy. We have such great economic productions, not just because of immigrant workers, but immigrants themselves have purchasing power. When they, when they make wages and they have an income, they become our major consumers. They contribute to the economy not just as workers, but as big part of our consumer base. And I think that we need to start promoting the contributions, because I think that's another attack from the Trump administration, that we're taking away jobs, that we are a drain on the economy. We get benefits, even though undocumented immigrants don't qualify for any benefits. So I don't know what benefits he's referring to. But there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misleading information that we need to be doing the counterattack and changing the narrative.
Victor, please remind us how Trump's massive deportation plan is supposed to work. Does it make a distinction between categories of immigrants, those who are here on special visas or the DACA students whose parents brought them to America when they were very young, or those without documentation and working on farms and fast food restaurants and in hospitals? Does Trump's plan really take into account the fact that there are a number of different categories of undocumented workers and partially documented workers here in America today?
Well, he's vowed to have the greatest deportation plan of all in history. I mean, he bases his from the Eisenhower administration, the foundation of Operation Wetback, when they did a huge deportation process. But many U.S. citizens, many legal people with legal status were deported under that process. So they stopped that deportation process, that deportation program immediately. But he claims he has the ability and the resources to engage in the largest deportation ever. Tom Holman, his immigration, his border czar, is kind of leading this effort, leading the narrative. They have made it clear that they're, now prioritizing people with serious, been convicted of serious crime. But he, a few days ago went on the air to make it known that anybody will be subject to his the deportation plan. They're using collateral, what the concept of collateral arrest. Under, back in 2011, under Obama, and then Biden also kept this policy. ICE, Immigration Enforcement, and Homeland Security agree that they will engage in targeted enforcement, which means they go after a particular individual, but not anybody else in the surrounding areas. As we've seen in Chicago, what happened recently, they made it clear that if ICE enforcement is happening in a particular area and they're going after a certain individual, they are also free to question anybody, to detain anybody in that particular neighborhood, a particular vicinity, which is, means like every anybody can get caught. And this is why like U.S. citizens were arrested recently. This is why you know, people with legal status were arrested and detained, because they are using collateral arrest as the hallmark. And then he's also, they've also made it clear that they're not going to respect the longstanding policy of staying away from schools, health clinics, churches, these areas where, you know, they've always historically stayed away from. They made it clear that they're going to go into the schools, they're going to go into churches, they're going to go into health clinics. So they're dismantling, they're eradicating all the agreements of the past of how they were going to confine immigration enforcement. Anybody's a target. Basically, what they've been doing is, if you have brown skin, you're going to be targeted. You can be questioned, you can be detained, even though their enforcement operation may be going after particular individuals. They've made it clear they're going to target anybody within their sight.
Victor, there are tens of thousands of immigrants in the country today who came here from very dangerous, dire situations in their home country. And they've come here and they've applied for asylum in America, which under international law they have every right to do. So how does the Trump plan intend to treat that group of immigrants, that large group who are here seeking, as they have every right to do, political asylum? How is it that category of immigrants, which is going to keep growing, what's been the, will be the effect of that on the Trump plans?
One of the things that they don't like political asylum. I mean, one of his major attacks has been, he claims political asylum has been a fallacy. Like it's been a, he connects political asylum with open borders. And his claim is that it's been an abuse of the political asylum system. He's making the same reference to like temporary protected status and other, you know, other kinds of immediate, you know, deferred action relief for immigrants, and he wants to get rid of it all, and he wants to restrict asylum status. He claims that our version of political asylum, the Democrats have connected it with open borders. We're going to continue. I mean, there's a lot of, one of the fight back is there are a lot of asylum petitions where, you know, immigration lawyers and immigrant rights organizations are going to continue to fight for the rights of people here under asylum petitions. The issue there, the concern I have is that the Department of Justice regulate the administrative process of immigration proceedings. They control the judges. They oversee that process because it's not, you know, it's within, under the purview of the Department of Justice, and they can change the metrics, which I think that's something that they're going to be doing soon if they're having this, changing the metrics that the immigration judges use to determine outcomes of asylum cases. They, in essence, going to pressure immigration judges to grant more deportations. And so under the asylum process, you have the right to appeal. And I think we're going to continue the fight to make sure within the legal system to fight as much as possible for people here under asylum petitions. The bigger crisis is when people try to seek asylum, because they are, in essence, just restricting the borders so severely that it's almost impossible to seek asylum. So we need to figure out that fight. We need to use international law. We need to just use anything we can to push back on their attempts to really eradicate the future prices of seeking asylum.
The vast majority of undocumented immigrants that Trump intends to round up and deport are people of color. They're from Central America and South America. Is it your contention that America's efforts to deport them by the millions is, at least in part, racist?
I think the answer to that is a strong yes. But, you know, keep in mind, this is a repeat of what he did in 2016, 2017, when he was targeting groups from different countries, creating ban, travel bans, like the Muslim ban. He, you know, it was one example. He targets specific groups from different countries and labels them as terrorists, as a threat to democracy, as a national security threat. But it's all racist motivated by strong deep level of racism. And We should just call it out for what it is, you know. And, you know, Stephen Miller, his cabinet, you know, they're all racist. And they have strong racist feelings against certain groups. And I have no qualms of calling it out for what it is, you know.
Victor, I wonder just how realistic it is. Trump is famous for being a boaster, but how realistic it is that Trump will be able actually to create a program of roundups and deportations that will add up to millions of undocumented immigrants being deported. What are the costs involved in such a program? The cost for detention centers, more military at our border, more immigration judges. The cost of all that, I'm wondering, do you'd like to comment on? And even if he received all of the money he claims to need for such a massive enterprise, is he likely to succeed in deporting the numbers of immigrants he claims he'll be able to remove? And finally, what role does fear of detection on the part of undocumented immigrants have on the success of Trump's plans? I mean, I would note, and I think you paid reference to this already, that last week it's estimated that while small numbers were apprehended by ICE, several times as many are believed to have voluntarily left the country out of fear. So talk to us about the chances of Trump really being able to get the money needed to do all the deportations he's talked about and this other effect of fear.
There's a lot of analysis out there that how much it's going to cost and everything, but my main concern is he's shifting the entire federal government enforcement regime in this direction. He's already got, FBI, drug enforcement, U.S. Marshals, all the federal agencies that do enforcement working on this immigration policy. He's instructed the Department of Justice to instruct the U.S. Attorney's offices throughout the country to prioritize immigration enforcement over other crimes. So he's shifting all the federal government agencies in that direction. If we continue to organize, because what happened in Chicago is very important. They didn't have the outcome. They didn't get the outcome they anticipated. So there was a lot of frustration. Tom Holman on, CNN was frustrated at how well-educated immigrant community members were in Chicago about not participating, not cooperating. And he's upset with the immigrant rights groups, with all the social justice groups for educating community members about their rights. He claims now we're interfering with law enforcement. So I think it shows the power that we have. We're doing it in Los Angeles. We're doing it in other cities throughout the country. We're working together. We're like everybody's as much as possible is being educated about their rights, because that's the first part of the battle. Then the second part of the battle is what we do when they do show up. You know, and it goes beyond just creating strong sanctuary policies. It's what do we do on the streets? But the first part of it, educating as many community members as possible, I think we're winning that. We just got to keep it up. We just got to keep educating immigrant households, immigrant families. One thing I failed to mention in the past, you know, this is not just an issue of deporting undocumented immigrants. What happens in this country, data have shown statistics, is immigrant families in this country are mixed households. They have, which means that you have either U.S.-born citizens or legal permanent resident citizens in the same household as undocumented students. A lot of my students at UCLA who are undocumented students, you know, they come from mixed households. They have one parent might be a U.S. citizen and the other parent who may not be, documented. And so we need to keep in mind this is story. It's not just the issue of deporting undocumented immigrants. It's you're destroying immigrant families. You're destroying this whole community of, you know, immigrant communities and families throughout the whole country. And that has an impact on them as well. But the more we involve community members, the more we involve families in the resistance, getting to know their rights, but also fighting back, you're going to see the same outcome in Chicago, where they go in expecting thousands of arrests and only coming out with a handful of number. And now they're threatening to go after the groups. They're threatening to go after, you know, social justice groups, immigrant rights groups, people like us for educating community members about their rights. So I think the more we keep the resistance and keep working together and being solidarity, that's going to really determine, I think, the success of the outcome of his immigration deportation plan.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with immigration attorney and teacher at the University of California in Los Angeles, Attorney Victor Nero. Victor, let's talk more about what happened in Chicago. Last week, when ICE and other federal law enforcement officials were in Chicago rounding up immigrants for deportation, police officials refused to join them in their efforts. After federal officials threatened to prosecute the local policing officials for their non-cooperation, the Trump administration now says it's got a right to prosecute anyone who stands in the way in connection with its deportation efforts. Talk to us, please, about this. Hasn't it always been illegal to actively interfere with ICE agents coming into a city to round up and deport immigrants? But can the federal government actually prosecute local law enforcement officials who simply stand aside and do no more than refuse to work actively with ICE to identify and round up immigrants for deportation?
Federal immigration law enforcement is a federal issue. And they, you know, we are not interfering with ICE and other federal agencies to be able to come in and do their operations and their enforcement. What we're saying is we're not required by law to participate in that. What we're saying is we're refusing to cooperate. We don't want to cooperate. We don't want to share information. This is the concept, the strength of sanctuary policies. And then when we're educating community members, we're not interfering. Like if I'm educating a group of community members, I'm not interfering with, we know ICE is going to be coming. We know federal immigration enforcement is going to do their enforcement operations. We're educating members of the community about their rights, their constitutional rights to be silent, the constitutional rights not to cooperate, not to answer questions. I don't know where that's illegal. You know, I don't see any way that can be illegal. We're just educating about rights they have under the law. We're not physically keeping federal law enforcement officers from entering into the city or entering into public spaces. They can go into any public spaces they want. But they're not going to have any cooperation from the community, any cooperation from groups, any cooperation from police or city departments. They're on their own, but we're not going to physically interfere with their operations. We're just telling them, we're standbys. You're on your own. You're going to have to do the work by yourself.
And in terms, Victor, in terms of what you mentioned, the immigrant rights groups that I assume are already organizing, already training, you're already talking about how the information on the rights of American citizens to protest in the streets over what ICE and what the Trump administration is doing are already underway. You make the point that so long as those demonstrations are not interfering actually with the work of these ICE agents, they're perfectly legal, even though Trump has said that he intends to, you know, even prosecute citizens who somehow are even demonstrating. He's even made an offhanded comment about that. The legality of that, though, is more than in question. It would seem as though it's clearly illegal. Do you anticipate, nevertheless, that there will be CD, civil disobedience actions, that the communities in places like Los Angeles, where, in fact, the majority of people in Los Angeles are immigrants or have immigrant heritage and immigrant past, do you suspect that the Trump administration will nevertheless try in those instances to actually go after organizations that are engaged in what we would normally think of as perfectly lawful First Amendment protest?
Well, they're going to try to go after organizations. We know it's coming. This is where solidarity helps. Like if they go after a specific immigrant rights organization because they're doing an effective job of fighting back of community outreach and resistance, they're going to probably target those groups. We need to be there. Like if they target one group, they target all of us. This is what we really need to be strong in community and solidarity with each other. But what happens on the streets, you know, it's different layers of strategies, right? We have rapid response networks set up. So when ICE agents do show up in a particular area, we can all mobilize and show up there quickly. You can be in public streets protesting. We see Jim on the street, like, you don't just get in the way of immigration enforcement officers when they're doing an operation, but you can be close enough to protest loudly. You can record in public. We can even get the media out there. We can put that kind of pressure on them. And then the next layer, of course, is the conscious decision to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, which there's already movements happening where people are signing up, pledge of resistance. You know, it's similar to what we've seen in prior crisis when we address an issue that has such a large impact on community members that we sign our own pledge of resistance to engage in civil disobedience. And then when the arrests do happen, when do get detained and arrested, then we have to fight it within the legal system. But that's the process of nonviolence, is to create that crisis for them. And I think that many of us are going to be engaging in that as well. The Trump administration doesn't believe in the First and Fourth Amendment. Anybody who denounces this policy is in violation of something. It could be, you know, putting something, a message out there he disagrees with, it's a violation. If you're on the streets protesting, addressing an issue, or even responding to one of his immigration operations on the streets with a protest, that's a violation. So anything that we do proactively is going to be a violation. Trump has a total lack of disregard for the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment. But, you know, we're going to continue. We're going to continue fighting. We know the risk involved, but there's so much at stake. So much at stake. If we lose this issue of immigration, because his stuff is not only focused on immigration. He's going to go after the labor movement. He's going to go after not just workers, but the entire labor movement. There's so much at risk right now, not just with immigrant rights, but with workers' rights, environmental justice, that we all need to engage in this fight together and fight back strong.
Yeah, Victor, before we ask to tell our listeners how people can get a hold of you and follow your work, I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One is the Trump administration has raised the idea of quotas, like 1,500 people a day they want to pick up. And also, they've said they want to start sending people to Guantanamo Bay, the famous torture prison that the United States runs in Cuba. Can you comment on the quota question and Gitmo, please?
Yeah, the Trump administration is going to go after anybody. You know, it's just not one particular group of immigrants. It's going to go after anybody that can get their hands on. He needs numbers. And I think, you know, to satisfy himself and his supporters, he needs to show numbers. And he's going to do anything he can to increase the numbers. And, you know, if you round up U.S. citizens and detain them, he's going to count those as numbers. He's, you know, you use military cargo planes. He uses that as numbers. Like, we don't know how filled they are, but he's going to claim they're filled up with a huge number of immigrants. Guantanamo Bay, my hope is we can put forth legal challenges to what he wants to do, but that's 30,000 he's talking about. Now he's going to boast that he's going to house 30,000 immigrants there. He's already using the numbers before it even happens. So I think with him, it's all about numbers, rhetoric, but there is a reality that he is trying very hard to come through with his promises. We need to pace ourselves. You know, that, you know, we're only 9 days into his administration, or, you know, less than 2 weeks. We need to pace ourselves too, and not so much, you know, be drained by his rhetoric and his social media posts, but we just need to be more strategic and focusing on the actions, the stuff that he's doing, and the operations and everything. And I think that way we can pace ourselves, because we got 4 years of this coming up, so we need to figure out the sustainability. Like, the best thing to reach out to me is, you go to the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights has the Rapid Response Network. You could go to their website. There's so many websites, to go through in California. Look at the immigrant rights groups. Find out who's, there are great immigrant rights groups and social justice groups leading this effort in many different cities. My role has been more in Los Angeles because that's where I'm located. But throughout the country, you know, the National Employment Law Center is doing, also information about the workplace, and the labor movement now is starting to become more concerned about ICE actions in the workplace. So there's many different ways for people to get connected. The issue is not to be alone. You see community members or other organizations feel like they're alone in this. Connect them. We just need to be connected to the vast networks of resistance that's taking place right now.
Thank you so much for being with us today here on Law and Disorder. That's good advice you've given. And we thank you so much for your appearance here today.
Thank you so much, and let's continue to struggle together.
You have our complete solidarity, Victor. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Listening to Audible Sounds on 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. The date is May 26th, and today we've got beats and grooves from Los Angeles, New York, Berlin, and Soho. But before we get to that, today's bin tracks are as follows. This is the artist Mid playing beneath me, featuring Channel Trace. A little later on, we got Faithless with Peace and Noise. And a little later still, we got Shy Girl with True Religion, featuring Isabella Love Story and Pink Panthers.
Hope you enjoy. Priceless, you know? Talk to him.
Straight to your arms, this is where I belong. Never get down on yourself. Sometimes life can be so hard. I'm still a fly snake out here. It's been like that since the school year.
Lights come on. I wanna be forever free. When the game is on the line, championship teams know the game plan. They communicate and work together to win. We all need a game plan to protect ourselves online. Talk to family and friends so they know how to stay safe too. Create strong passwords, turn on multi-factor authentication, update software, and recognize and report phishing. Because online safety is not something you want to fumble. Get more game-winning tips at cisa.gov/secureourworld. Then share them with family and friends.
On Joe's Garage. Monday night starting at 7 p.m. Shift into gear as we dust off the vinyls, rewind the tapes, and polish the CDs. Playing the best and some forgotten tracks from legendary artists and new releases from rising stars. From punk to funk, reggae to rock, get your motor running on Joe's Garage. Monday nights at 7 p.m. only on 88.3 WRCT. You're listening to Audible Sounds, and this next segment comes courtesy of the collection Los Angeles X Berlin from Your Mom's Agency.
plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Thank you.
Top 40 radio sounded like in the 1970s? We don't, but Jay Thurber might. Say, okay, Gen Xer, and tune into Radio 9 from 12 to 3 p.m. Saturdays for your mix of oldies, newies, and snark. Here on Independent Freeform Radio 88.3 WRCT.
I don't know. So what I see happening with this generation is really trying to have the rhetoric mean something, not to throw out the rhetoric, but to say, okay, guys, we're being tested. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Not what are we going to say, but what are we going to do? Are we going to divest? Are we going to not let weapons companies recruit on our campus? Like, what are we going to do materially that we can do? And we have to do it.
That's Naomi Klein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Naomi Klein. What are we going to do? The day after the Trump election, the New York Times wrote, America stands on the precipice of an authoritarian style of governance never before seen in its 248-year-old history. For many, the results of November 5th confirmed the view that we are in dark times. So the big question is, what are we going to do? We can wallow in self-pity and depression, or we can find kindred spirits, organize, and form alliances to not just resist the repression to come, but to promote progressive causes. As writer Rebecca Solnit says, not acting is a luxury those in immediate danger do not have, and despair something they cannot afford. But despair is all around us, telling us the problems are insoluble, that we are not strong enough, our efforts are in vain, and no one really cares. Hope, Rebecca Solnit says, counteracts cynicism and pessimism. Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She's professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, On Fire, and Doppelganger. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. The moderator is Professor Nabil Isha Aibi. And now, Naomi Klein.
I want to thank everybody who invited me here. It's been a long time since I've been on this wonderful campus, and it's got such a rich activist tradition, green activism and human rights and anti-war. I want to shout out the students who have been organizing and taking risks, including students who've been suspended for their activism. But I really do want to thank you for just your boldness, because courage is it really is a muscle, you know, and when we start saying, well, maybe not this week, we get used to it, and suddenly it feels like a bigger deal to just do what it is our unbelievable privilege to do, read, think, discuss, debate. How lucky are we, you know, who work at universities, whether we are on faculty or whether we're students, that this is actually our job. This is what we're doing here. This is our work. And when we voluntarily shut ourselves up, I think it's such a disservice to people who are having to do so much more difficult work and who don't have that privilege of just being asked to tell the truth for a living, for their studies. So thank you so much.
I want to start, you know, with a few questions, obviously, about the book, and congratulations on Doppelganger and the success that it's had. And there is this line in the book where you're talking about your book, The Shock Doctrine. When you shared the galleys with John Berger, the writer, he told you that book, and like what other people had told you, that the Shock Doctrine actually enraged them, he told you that it provoked and instilled in him a sense of calm. And I want to start there.
Okay.
This idea of calmness and calm as a form of resistance in times of shock and also times of chaos and confusion.
Yeah. To be clear, I don't, you know, when I say that I'm I'm trying to bring a sense of calm, you know, to myself and to the reader. I'm not trying to make you panic. I'm not saying everything is fine. You know, I'm not saying chill out. But I do think that it is a precondition for being strategic, for making priorities, and that when we are in a state of shock, we have event without a narrative that can explain that event. And that's when we get vulnerable and become vulnerable to people who would manipulate us. I got interested in this after 9/11, watching how powerful people in this country in particular, but around the world, used the shock of 9/11 to regress us, to tell us that nothing we knew before applied. There was this phrase that some of you who are you know, old enough to remember that period will recall, which was they would say, oh, that's pre-9/11 thinking, as if nothing you knew before mattered. And in fact, the impulse that many, many people had was to get oriented, to get out of shock, and to do that together. By gathering, you know, there were these spontaneous gatherings around New York City where people just got together and talked in different squares. People, you know, Noam Chomsky's book sold out, you know, because people wanted to understand, okay, why do they hate us? What happened? And in response to that, there was like, to try to understand is to betray, is to rationalize, right? You know, we heard this after October 7th as well. Anything contextualizing, right, is a thought crime. History began on October 7th. That's all that matters. And everything, you know, nothing justified October 7th, but just October 7th justifies everything. I think, you know, one of the things I noticed from immersing myself in conspiracy culture and following my doppelganger down her various rabbit holes and listening to a lot of Steve Bannon is the affect of that world is panic. There's always a hot new reason for you to panic. And I think that that's because when you are panicked, you are childlike. You're looking for, you know, a strong arm figure to stabilize you, protect you, right? And, you know, I'm sure we're all thinking about different people who are playing that role. So, yeah, I mean, I want us to be as calm as we can be in the storms that we are in, because I think that that's how we are at our best. But it isn't to minimize the fact that there's a hell of a lot for us to be very, very deeply and seriously concerned about. It's not the British kind of keep calm and carry on sort of thing. I absolutely do I believe in revolutionary change. I mean, I think that business as usual is catastrophic on many different fronts. For me as a writer, I'm always trying to get unpanicked and calm. I mean, all of my books are attempts to impose some kind of an order. And it's not that the world is ordered when I'm done. It's that my thoughts are ordered and I'm able to interact with the world. And I think that's what we look to nonfiction for, fiction a little bit less so, but you know, we, and I think that's what, you know, the wonderful late John Berger was saying to me, and I was so moved by it. You know, I think he was not shocked by the information in the shock doctrine. He remembered many of the events, and when he was saying he felt calm was that it was there on the page. The shock doctrine looks at